want to set the stage here to talk a little bit about why real estate. And part of what I think about, if I'm in all of your shoes and you're approaching an organization like ours that puts money to work, we're, as I mentioned, we're a registered investment advisor. We have over $4 billion of assets under management. I know we're going to talk a fair amount about approaching family offices. I do believe the large RA community is a great opportunity. I think it's fairly untapped. I would recommend that you only approach $1 billion-plus RAs, and there's databases out there that can provide that contact information. But I will tell you that I would get, I believe, and I talk to a lot of other RAs out there in the country, very few of them have exposure to private real estate. And I personally believe that they're going to lose market share by not having exposure to private investments, private equity, private credit. And that's part of what I've been passionate about within our practice. So we have a very formidable private investment platform. As I mentioned, we have about $400 million in private real estate that we've put to work for our clients, about $200 million of private credit, and about $50 million of private equity, but we're trying to work to build out that private equity platform. But if I was in your shoes approaching somebody like myself that perhaps didn't know a lot about real estate and why real estate versus stocks and bonds, most organizations like ours invest their clients' money in an assortment of stocks and bonds, whether it be mutual funds, individual bonds, or stocks. That's the traditional portfolio. And most RAs out there, those are the two instruments that they use to build a portfolio for their clients. This is a great chart. Dr. Glenn Mueller serves on the board of Arden. He's the professor at Denver University and an adjunct professor at Harvard. He presents at some of our functions. This is a slide that he presented. He does a lot of cycle work. Some of you probably buy his research. Right here kind of says it all. And we've seen the volatility in the stock market over the last couple of weeks, and the anxiety that that brings to investors is huge. The pain of loss is 10 times greater than the joy of gain for investors. And that's the beauty about non-traded investments, and that's the beauty of real estate. It can be a wonderful asset class from a behavioral finance standpoint. The other thing is when you look at most clients who are clients of large RAs, tend to be 55, 60 plus. They've made their money. They don't want to take a lot of risks. They don't want to count on the stock market to make their returns, but they need to keep up with inflation. They need income. So take a look at this chart here. The last 81 years, according to Dr. Glenn Mueller, and this is the NCREIF Index, real estate, private real estate, in the last 81 years has only produced 5 negative return years, versus stocks has produced 20 negative years, and bonds 21 negative years. And so real estate has been a very stable asset class. And you also have to remember is people like us are dealing with a very limited opportunity set right now with bond yields at 2-3%. That just is not going to get our clients home. And stock levels in the U.S. are at all-time highs. So right now, as many of you probably feel like you don't have as much opportunity in real estate as you had 2 years ago, we believe there's some great opportunities still relative to stocks and bonds. But maybe we'll talk about that. Let's maybe go down the line here and just talk about this here, and how would you all recommend that this group approach family offices, RAs, to educate them, and then also to talk about the benefits and to get on the platform. So maybe we'll start there. Paul, if you want to start.
Sure. So the chart is great. Obviously, real estate is great. I think that some people might say that if you put up some of the other alternative assets up there, that they would be on par with real estate in terms of the portion of the years that are up versus down. I do think that despite the momentum that real estate has, that people are starting to think about, is there a top coming in certain segments of the marketplace? So I think most of you know, if you go to New York City, land prices are pretty expensive. So some people might say it's not easy to really justify some of the high-end multifamilies and cores that are being built. And I think, as you know, in the last 5 years, the public markets and equities have done very well. So a lot of people have gone to passive investing and have done well with that. But I think over the last 6 to 12 months, a lot of hedge funds, a lot of private equity firms have gone out there and said, well, maybe now's the time for more active management. And I think that as you approach investors going forward, that may be something that real estate funds may also want to do, is to talk about how you're going to do if there is an environment going in the future where there might be additional volatility, not only in the stock market, but also in the real estate space. And so that might be something to think about.
I think as you approach, these high net worths or these institutional investors and family offices, you need to clearly communicate your strategy and how it meets with their goals for investment. I mean, our strategy is, value add with current cash flow in place, and then ultimately to, reposition the asset and make a healthy return in IRR for the investor that's going to fit into their portfolio for that allocation.
Great. Chris, maybe share a little bit about, you have a vehicle that's very attractive from an income standpoint. If you think about it right now, we are in a no interest rate world, right, or low interest rate world. People need income and stability. People that are 60 plus need income and stability. Real estate can be a wonderful, wonderful asset class to produce that. You have a vehicle like that. You distribute that broadly. You have a unique structure. So maybe just spend a little time, talk about your structure, how you approach the market, who your customers are, and provide some advice to the folks out here, what you've learned in that process and how to approach the market.
Sure. Absolutely. As Tony was alluding to, our core product is a triple net lease focused private REIT. It's about $1.6 billion in assets right now, 340 properties. Very big focus on income, as you brought up. Usually we've been running around a 7% dividend and tell folks to project in low double digits. So it's nothing crazy. There's not a lot of development risk. It's very thoughtful and conservative for the 55 to 65 type client you're talking about. And it's performed tremendously well over the last 5 and 7 years as triple net lease has become very popular and as a substitute for income. We've accidentally found our way into the RIA and high net worth space. We always thought we might go institutional and get that. But we really carved out a niche there by working with, I assume, a lot of firms that are very similar to Tony, and it's really a couple of different facets that do well there. One, it's a very intensive process to get on some of these platforms, but it's also a very rewarding process as you sort of get your feet underneath you and go through the due diligence and things like that. It's relationship driven. It's a high level of service. You're not only serving the RIA, but you're also serving, let's say, their 150 clients underneath there. Those folks really like to hear from us, like client events or seminars where we might come and present. A lot of the client-facing folks, frankly, call in our investor relations team, which is all internal, 7 folks, and do individual calls to walk through the product. Our minimum's pretty high at $500,000, so they really like to know the team and know, our strategy and things of that nature. And then it's routine and clear follow-up, as Joe sort of alluded to, all coming together to make them comfortable for the long term. But in terms of the income and the structure and being available to RIAs when they need it, that's really sold quite well, frankly, in the last couple of years.
So it's open-ended structure, which is very attractive, meaning that they always have it available. If a new client comes in, they can write a ticket or put a portion of that in and allocate it to your fund.
Yep.
And what's the time horizon of your fund typically while it's open?
So it's completely open-ended. We have a liquidity program where folks can get out quarterly, and you're exactly right. So especially with growing RIAs, if you're able to develop relationships with those people who are continually adding new clients, it's actually a really wonderful gradual ramp with them. Usually it takes 18 to 24 months, I'd say, where they might have the first clients go in who are some of the largest or most aggressive and are willing to take sort of the first toe in the water. And then usually between 3 and 6 months, we sort of hit our stride with an RIA, and they bring in sort of the fat part of the bell curve with their clients. And then after that, it's new clients as they come in.
So what I like about your product is you began with the end in mind, because you really went out and met the needs of the marketplace. The marketplace needs income, and the RIA needs access at all times. Yep. Your vehicle really meets the advisor's needs as well as their client's needs. Yep. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But, so let's move on and chat some more about accessing family offices and registered investment advisors.
Ours is a little bit different. We actually go directly to high net worth individuals and we talk with them directly. So a lot of the ways we approach them is they'll want to commit a certain dollar amount. A lot of times it's larger than the 500. They'll say, I want to commit $20 million to your company. And within that $20 million, we'll say, okay, well, we'll diversify you in the next 5 or 6 deals. Their returns are a lot larger. They're not the, you know, the 7% or the 9%. It's more of the 30, 40, 50, 60% IRRs. There's risk with it because we're a land, you know, entitlement, and it takes time, and it has to be patient money. But we're adding the value to the properties, and that's their capital is safe because we're buying it at such a low basis, and we're going in and changing all the entitlements. We're going through CEQA. We're going through all the environmental issues. And, you know, so what we're buying isn't clean, and it, you know, we may think it's going to take 18 months to complete, and it may take, you know, 2, 3, 4 years even. But the returns typically are there, and I would say I can't, other than our co-invest, I don't think we've ever lost anyone's money in the 13 years that we've been in business.
And Jim, when you approach these investors, how did you get access to those investors? I mean, was it through attorneys, accountants?
Exactly. Yeah, it's through attorneys. It's through we had two large investors, and they actually referred, once they started to make a, you know, good returns, they introduced us to more. And I would say 90% of our investment base, they all know each other now. It almost gives them a little bit more of a comfort that they're almost all in it together. Like, they feel that there's this camaraderie now. It's not just people that they don't know. They know our faces. You know, we deal with them. They come in and you know, I would say on a monthly or bi-monthly basis. And our structure is, I mean, we do reporting for them on a you know, quarterly basis, but the way we're structured is, if you want to know what's going on with your investments, you can come in on May 12th, and we'll have it ready for you, and we can go through it just to give you the peace of mind. And I think that is also really important to them, especially because of the high dollar amounts that they're putting in. But also, you can come in at any time, and we'll give you up-to-date results on where we're at, what's going on with the entitlements, and where their money sits at any point in time, separate from any quarterly reporting that we give them.
Great, thanks, Jim. Danny, if you could, we haven't really spent a lot of time talking about approaching family offices, and I believe you have the most experience of all of us in how to approach a family office. Maybe you could share a little bit about that, and share a little bit about your structure, your company,
sure.
And your value add, as far as how you approach interface between the end client and the real estate
sure.
manager.
Sure, absolutely. Well, let's just be honest. You don't approach them. That's not how it works. So the truth is, family offices, and similar to what you just heard, is a referral business. And it takes a contact. It takes a warm introduction to even get a first meeting. So the family office world, they deploy typically larger amounts of capital at one time, right? We're not talking $100,000 or $500,000, we're talking millions at a time. And for them to trust an allocator or an operating partner to take that money and invest it requires patience and determination, to say the least. The process is totally different than when approaching an RIA. So our business is both, right? We have RIA clients where it's more institutionalized, and the process we'll go over later. And on the family office side, it is absolutely an organically based referral methodology. However, when you service those clients the way you do, with this hand-holding, white glove customization, is where the relationship really tends to grow. So thereafter, transparency, discretion, kick the tires, those types of things you don't really have with the RIA investors, and it's in a different way. So for us, we started and we were founded as a family office, real estate family office, advisory firm, and have grown to be advisors to RIAs as well. And they're totally two different investor groups, and we treat them differently. And while the investment is the same, so our family offices will co-invest alongside our RIA accounts, the treatment and the reporting and the hand-holding is completely different.
Great. So Danny, one of the things you mentioned was the process, and what I wanted to share with all of you, the last time the SEC came into our organization and did an examination, they spent their entire examination reviewing our private investments. So this is a real focus for the regulators, and they expect that we're doing very formal due diligence, and we've put very formal due diligence processes in place. We have a couple of people within our practice that that's all they do is do research and due diligence on managers. So we're large enough that we can afford to have that in-house. There are some organizations that you can farm that service out to, but Danny, can you talk a little bit more? Maybe Chris, you want to talk about it as well. You've been through that process, but talk about what this crowd needs to be prepared for when you go in. You don't just go in and get a relationship tomorrow and have $160 million on your doorstep like we've developed. It's been years that we've worked together in the trust we have, and we've known each other for years before that to get to where we're at in our relationship. So it's just kind of a slowly ramping deal. Sometimes we'll even give a manager a small amount just to get a relationship developed, and if it goes well and we have trust in them, then it'll start to grow and we'll go to the next level with them at a later time. But Danny, can you talk about that, please?
So I'll start with family office. This is the extent, and I'm definitely summarizing and giving to you an approximate dialogue. Who are you? Who else invests with you? And can I see your track record? Can we talk about your track record? Can I see some projects? That's as far as it goes. And then it's about how do they know you? Who else knows you? And so once that comfort starts, that the due diligence is really refined to a very minimal amount. Typically, because they don't have in-house capabilities, so they're relying on a gut instinct. Most of the time, they made their own wealth and feel that their gut has some merit and they believe in it. So now I'll take you to the RIA side, which I know these gentlemen will expand on. It starts with an introduction. They take about 6 months to figure out if they'd rather go REIT or private. They'll take another 6 months to figure out where we are in the cycle, even though they're not typically real estate experts. Then they're going to send you a DDQ, which is a due diligence questionnaire that tends to be between 50 and 100 pages, asking you about every question about your business that you have ever wanted to answer. So the extent of it is, how many employees have you, let go in the last 10 years? Who are your third-party vendors? What's your backup system for your IT? Who's your IT provider? I mean, they're going at a business level, less about your strategy. And they do go to your strategy, but I know you'll expand, but the amount of questions related to you as an business owner and functioning operating company was very surprising to us, because we come from the real estate world. So why aren't you asking if our strategy makes sense in this market, and how do you, how do you mitigate risk? Those questions are last. 90% of the review is on you as a business, and how are you structured? How are you making money? Who are your biggest investors? What happens if they leave? I mean, these are questions that we were just not prepared for. I mean, clearly now we are. So it's polar on the raising capital and the amount of work you have to do for either one of them.
Chris, do you want to touch on your experience in working through the due diligence process with the RAs and family offices?
Absolutely. I guess I've probably seen maybe a little bit of a wider range than you have in experiences. We've had RIAs move as fast as maybe 3 months after they decided they liked something, and we've had some that have gone absolutely to the extreme, like you said, a year and a half maybe of different meetings, thinking about it, various committees. And I think it depends on the size of the organization and the culture as well, and how keyed in they are to the process. And frankly, it's another good thing that Tony said, is whether they really have a specialist that focuses on alternatives and real estate makes a big difference in how that process progresses as well. I think the other things that are really important from a sort of box checking procedure is who's your accounting firm, who's your auditing firm. Once we made this switch from a regional firm to E&Y, that was a big change for a lot of people that disqualified us from. And then secondarily, a 5-year track record, if you're having an open-ended product, made a big difference for us as well to be able to show that and have that verified. And there's some things you can do to make it easier. I've been through those DDQs at different points as well. We actually got tired of kind of filling them out and created our own as a way to try to sort of jumpstart the process. setting up a data room as soon as someone's interested, and we've sort of pre-populated a lot of that stuff because some of it is routine, and then you have to go and customize for the specific questions that that group has that isn't covered by those things. But the process absolutely can be as protracted as a year and have that level of diligence go through. And then, you know, oftentimes there is then the secondary focus on the strategy and the real estate.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about the opportunity out there. I've heard after this downturn in 2008 that CalPERS and some other organizations were going to start moving more money into commercial real estate because they like the stability, they like the risk profiles. So where do you think right now when you look at the typical RA, where you look at the typical family office, I don't know if all of you have any indicators, but Chris, when you go into an RA or a family office, what do you see as far as their exposure to real estate and their desire?
Yeah.
Where are they at right now as far as wanting more exposure, less?
Oh, for sure it's more. And I think when you said earlier about having a dedicated specialist and the folks above $1 billion in assets under management almost certainly have an alternative specialist. So I think today, you know, the demand is a big part of it. I think the less correlation with the stock market is a big selling factor for them. I think they really appreciate that, you know, you're publishing a quarterly NAV or quarterly statements and you know, putting a lot of information in front of their clients, but they're not getting a dozen calls like they are today, you know, with big gyrations in the stock market over the last few weeks, everyone wanting to know what the approach is and what the strategy is. For us, life's pretty simple. When rent checks come in at the month, you know, that month's closed off, and obviously there's a lot more to it, but it's pretty stock and straightforward. So I would say the space and the amount of growth there is pretty high, and you know, even more globally, from just an RIA perspective, I think the day of the fee-based broker is really dying faster and faster. So I think more and more folks are shifting to your model as sort of an AUM approach. You're not compensated by whether you use my product or Joe's or anything like that. There's no sales fee, there's no commission, there's no conflict of interest in any way there. I think that's a real move that's happening faster and faster, and then those groups become more sophisticated and demand more real estate as well.
That's
great. Tony, I'd like to point out also that, you know, we talk about yield product because that's really attractive to the RIA space, which is true. I mean, clearly a lot of the underlying clients are looking for yield replacement, but in the family office rule, that's not the case, at least for our client base. So for our clients, getting a check, a quarterly check, that's literally rounding down to them is meaningless. They're actually quite annoyed. So for our clients, our family offices are most attracted to the value add opportunistic side of the risk profile, and conversely, our RIA clients are absolutely core plus investors. So we have the balance of having a wide spectrum of investment opportunities. But, you know, they're very different.
That's great insight because if you have a $100 million plus net worth, maybe getting a check in the mailbox isn't important. But one of the things we found, I had one of the CPAs in our firm say, yeah, you know, high net worth people that have $1 million or more. Well, we have clients that have $10, $20 million portfolios, but these people are professional spenders. They need that check in the mailbox. They need a lot of checks in the mailbox. So we're trying to keep up with these folks. So, and it's very difficult in a low rate world. That's the beauty of real estate. You got a great arbitrage opportunity right now. You got one of the things we created was a core fund. So we said, hey, core real estate in Minneapolis and St. Louis is pretty cheap. At least this was back 2-3 years ago. Let's create a fund. Let's take advantage of ultra low interest rates. Let's lock that money in, fixed for 7 years, and let's go buy fully leased stable real estate and arbitrage that, make that spread. And so we got a fund that we created that's producing about an 8.5% cash on cash yield, tax advantage, sheltered income. Clients love it. It's been great. So that really is, to me, we've never been in a period where there's been more demand for income because we have more people that are boomers that are retiring than ever, all while interest rates are at record lows. That is a huge opportunity for the people in this room. The other thing I want to share with you that's great about real estate, just met with my largest client last week. They have about 40% private real estate in their portfolio, doing extremely well. They have another liquid portfolio with another advisor that's all in the market, which obviously is getting hammered right now. And we have a lot of private credit, private equity. They only have 14% in the public market in our portfolio. And they just were so peaceful. And the thing I want to share with you, I believe one of the things that is our responsibility as advisors to our clients is to help manage our clients' money anxiety. I believe that the reason that clients hire me and advisors as much as trying to, you know, get them the returns they need and get good risk-adjusted returns, it's really to transfer that anxiety about their money. And the thing that I love about real estate, I don't have to sit here and look at a statement every month with them or a statement every quarter and watch this volatility. So that's a huge value out of real estate. I love, personally, as an investor, I love having my money in private real estate and private credit. I hate the public market, and I do this for a living. So, Paul, your family, you know, your family is an investor. You shared a little bit about, you know, your family situation, but what's your view of real estate from a family perspective and how you've allocated the family money to real estate and how you've positioned it from that perspective?
So that's always a complicated question, of course. So, you know, I think a lot of kind of perpetual funds are looking to allocate, I don't know, let's say 5-10% of their portfolio to real estate. But for example, you know, I sit on a foundation that supports a school. And so the foundation has $300 million of capital, and it says we don't want to be much more than 5 or 10% in real estate and real estate funds. But on the other hand, the school has $500 million of operating real estate. So do you count the $500 million of real estate as part of the institution's, you know, real estate exposure? You know, some people would say yes and some people would say no, but it makes a huge difference what your definition of exposure is. And while we're at it, we might want to talk a little bit about, of course, there's a lot of different kind of families in the United States, a lot of families outside the United States that are eager to get into the U.S., whether it's because the dollar is continuing to get stronger, whether it's because of the stability of the U.S. or otherwise. The dynamics of getting money from international families may be different, in some ways easier, some ways maybe harder.
Talk about that, though, Paul. That's great, because we did talk about that in New York, and you know more about that than all of us, but we know there's been some high-profile properties bought by foreign money. There's a ton of money coming in from China, for example. Any advice on how to access that or get exposure to that money?
I mean, I think that what I have seen is that if you work with the right person introducing you to these families, that it's almost too easy. But on the other hand, I would say that you have to be a little cautious as to who you take money from. And, you know, I don't want to get into all the dirty laundry, but there's a lot of money that does not want transparency, that they don't want you to know who actually is giving you the money. They don't want you to know, you know, who actually owns the property that that they're buying. And so you do have to be careful that you don't, just for the eagerness, you know, just so you're, you may be just too eager to raise money, but you do have to be careful who you take that money from. And so that's one thing you should be careful of.
Paul, are there any particular law firms or accounting firms that are dealing with a lot of those people that are looking to bring their money to the U.S.?
I mean, there are certainly, you know, plenty of professional firms, and you certainly want them to have local presence, you know, in the place, in the region where the investors are coming, so that they really do know who these people are. Because, you know, the New York office of, you know, XYZ accounting firm really isn't going to know, you know, where the money's coming from for, you know, some fund in Malaysia or something.
And what about EB-5 money? I mean, EB-5 typically is tied to employment. There's a lot of money, though, coming over for EB-5, which means you get a green card, basically, if you bring over capital for every, was it $5 million of capital that's brought to the U.S., there's a residency provided for that capital. Is anyone anyone here?
Yeah, I mean,
Is it $5 million or is it?
I think it's $500,000.
$500,000, I'm sorry. I knew it had a five in it, so $500,000. Nobody's familiar with that here, anyway? Okay. Well, let's open it up for questions, and then, yes, go ahead.
If you could address two questions I have. One, compare and contrast the family office IRA as it relates to one-off transactions versus funds, and also allocation to liquid and non-liquid investments.
You want to take that, Danny, or?
Sure. So there was three questions. Your first one is allocation to directs versus funds. So families, almost in this point in the after the downturn, are all directs that we work with. So unless they have a specific family trust that has a fund mandate. So some of our large families have certain types of trusts that require the trust to only invest through fund vehicles, in which case it's a customized fund of funds approach. But let's just go with the average, it's directs. On the RIA space, they don't typically have the in-house expertise or real estate department to vet individual transactions, so their job is to vet the manager and the product. And once that's been accepted, they relinquish that discretion to the manager.
The only thing I might add to that is the more sophisticated the RIA is, the more willing they are to do both one-off transactions and funds. So we have a pretty big spectrum. I know of some that just use our product as their only real estate investment, and there's plenty of ones that we work with that, you know, we're one of four funds that they like, and then they will also do direct project investing for a hotel in Cleveland or, you know, something like that. So it's all about the staff, again, and the sophistication of the RIA.
In our experience, we found that RIAs that are generally over $5 billion tend to have bigger alts departments and experts within them, and then they actually have specific people who can really get into the nitty-gritty on a deal-by-deal basis. And under $5 billion, certainly they may outsource it or have one or two people. Under $1 billion, there's nobody. You want to take illiquidity versus liquid?
You know, really, I think the illiquidity thing, most of the funds that we participate in don't have a liquidity mechanism. Now, there's some vehicles that Chris mentioned, their vehicle is open-ended, and they have is an interval fund, so you have quarterly liquidity.
Yeah, so we have quarterly liquidity and monthly investment horizons.
That is attractive, though. I will say that when you think about how to construct a fund, and you think about how to make it as attractive to the marketplace to raise as much capital, right? That's what you want to do. I would say having an interval fund with quarterly liquidity windows is very attractive. You'll probably get more money. There are some organizations that have different beliefs about liquidity. I don't have a huge desire to have liquidity for my clients. If we have good assets, why would we want to sell them? I personally like deals that are a little bit longer term. The other thing is, if we turn a property in 2 or 3 years, I got to go redeploy that capital. I really don't want to have to go put it back to work and do it for the next deal if I don't have to. But I do think that liquidity feature is helpful. We have some interval funds on the credit side that we've done with some folks, and that's been very attractive to our advisors and clients. So I think the interval fund is a good feature. And there are some great structures that we've seen coming out here with the new security laws and some law firms that have really come up with some great structures. So the interval fund, I think, is a great structure. I think the open-end structure that Chris has is something that's very attractive. It's constantly open to the RIA. You want to have that where it's not just open for 6 months, now we've got to go find the next deal. So,
if I can add something quickly to that, is that there are funds out there that have quarterly liquidity, even though it's a private equity fund, and those have become pretty popular. I have seen a lot of insurance companies and others that say, if you want me in for 5, 10, 20 years, I do want some kind of current return. And so there is some balance there.
Yes.
My question is, do you guys deploy portfolio loans for your credit on your securities-based loans to get credit, or do you only use commercial credit?
I'm sorry, are you asking, do we...
Probably at the property level, right? Not at the fund level.
Our funds are real estate investment trusts. They have corporate level debt, so they're all unsecured, low leverage.
Okay.
National syndicate of banks.
So they're all based on more commercial loans, not portfolio loans of securities.
No, that's correct. Yeah, they're there's just an unencumbered borrowing base that supports them. But or we do have some mortgages too.
Yeah. All our debt is at the property level.
Other questions? Great. Well, thank you for attending. Oh, we have one question in the back.
Yeah. What type of high net worth individuals, when they're making investments with small operators, small developers, what type of infrastructure are you looking for?
You want to answer?
Danny, you want to take that, or
no,
Jim?
About you. This
Jim?
Is a great one.
Are you asking what, you know, what kind of returns are they looking for?
No, due diligence.
Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah, so they typically want to know that you have an infrastructure. You're not just a little mom and pop, you know, shop where you have, you know, a whole, you know, you have your finance team, you have an accounting team, you have a legal team. We use all the big legal firms as well, Paul Hastings, Rutan & Tucker. A lot of times that's where we would get the introduction as well. We've used Deloitte & Touche for accounting. It gives them comfort knowing that all the infrastructure is in place, that, you know, that we're using very reputable type firms as well.
Great. Well, thanks, everyone. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you for attending, and enjoy your stay.